Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Stefan Hraber of Emisent coming to us from Brisbane, Australia. How's it going?
Great. All good down here in Australia, and thanks for having me on the show, Nathan.
Yeah, my pleasure. We're trying to get more diverse, geographically diverse folks on this show, so it's good to have you here. I had a guy last week from Spain, and before that, Sweden, so we're getting some good stuff, but we haven't really had that many Aussies or Kiwis, so welcome.
Okay, thank you.
Great. So what does Emisent do?
So we're about automating the collection and analysis of data in challenging GPS denied environments. What we do for now is using autonomous drones, and that's sort of our background, but it's not just about the drones. It's more about the data that the drones can collect, for asset owners that have sort of valuable assets in these underground GPS denied environments.
Okay. But, you know, for folks, maybe put it in even simpler language, you basically make drones that map out caves, correct?
Yeah, so that's definitely a big part of what we do. And usually the easiest way of explaining is if you've seen the movie Prometheus, it's a sci-fi movie, came out a couple of years ago. There's a scene in there where they release these little floating orb things which fly around in this Martian cave environment and then sort of have laser beams scanning the environment and then generating these beautiful 3D maps. And that's kind of what we're doing, but with drones.
So the next question is always, where'd you come up with this idea? Was it from watching the movie Prometheus? And that's an acceptable answer, if that's the truth.
No, it was actually the other way around. I think they got the idea from us. No, we've been doing this for a long time. So started off in CSIRO, which is Australia's national lab, in a robotics division. So that's where I've been for more than 12 years after doing my PhD in drone robotics. Drone autonomy. And so in that, in CSIRO, we spent more than 10 years developing autonomy for drones. So adding cameras and LIDAR and radar and other sensors to drones to allow them to perceive the world around them and basically, you know, not do silly things. And in parallel, there's another group in as part of our robotics team that we're working on laser-based mobile navigation and mapping using a technique called SLAM. And we kind of put the two together. So we took SLAM algorithms and combined them with our drone autonomy work that we've been doing before, and came up with a device which you can plug onto a drone called HoverMap, which provides these sort of kind of superpowers to the drone, allows it to fly without GPS, avoid obstacles in all directions, and other high level autonomy. And once we got that sort of as a really proof of concept running, we realized the potential for flying into challenging areas where there is no GPS. And as soon as sort of the mining industry got wind of this, we had a huge influx of inquiries. So it's kind of been just going from strength to strength focusing on underground mining because of the value of getting into some of these areas which are too dangerous to get into any other way.
Yeah. And the drones, I think I read, are made by DJI, the largest drone maker. So I guess the secret sauce is all in the sort of optics and mapping and the LIDAR and stuff.
Is that correct? Yeah, that's right. So I mean, we don't build the drones. We use off the shelf drones, and we are using DJI drones. They have a market lead, so it makes sense to integrate with them. And our core IP is really on the software which runs on the HoverMap payload, which is on the drone. So that's the drone autonomy and the SLAM based navigation. Mm-hmm. So that's the core of our focus is that software.
So, you know, we're going to talk about funding in just a moment, but in the context of that, this would knowing almost nothing about mining, this would sort of feel like a niche business, and most investors obviously don't like niche businesses. Is this niche, or is there a broader use case for this? I guess military or other, what are some other GPS challenge environments that this could go apply to?
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges for us was trying to narrow it down and focus because there are so many potential use cases. So we're starting with mining because that's where we've had by far the strongest pull from industry. And it's a really high value market. You said maybe in terms of numbers, it's not as big as some of the other markets, but it's really high value.
Yeah.
And it's a very challenging environment. So if we can crack, you know, the mining environment, then the others are actually much easier. But yeah, there are many areas sort of, I think most people don't realize that in most urban environments, you know, what you see above ground is kind of the tip of the iceberg. There's so much going on underground in the subterranean environment, with tunnels for road, rail, and other sort of utility and infrastructure that need to be built first of all, and then maintained and inspected. And yeah, it's not a nice environment to be in. So, you know, to get something to go around and inspect and map these areas is very valuable for sort of urban utilities. And then of course, yeah, there are defense-based applications, and I can sort of talk more about that. There's a DARPA challenge which has been launched recently that we're part of. So definitely defense applications. And then many other areas where you need to fly without GPS, even in a sort of urban canyon environment. If you've got in a downtown environment, GPS is usually very challenging. So if you want to fly around near buildings, you know, you can rely on our SLAM-based navigation as well. Indoors, so flying around inside warehouses or industrial plants, so flying into, you know, something like Fukushima to go and inspect after a disaster. So yeah, there's actually many, many places where GPS is either totally deprived or it's just not really good. So you need some other way of navigating instead of using GPS.
Yeah, interesting. I have a little handheld GPS, just a little tangent. And I went out yesterday on my little boat to go catch some crabs.
And okay.
Like the heaviest fog you've ever experienced. And I could probably see 10 feet in front of me. I'm trying to go out the Golden Gate. And so I'm totally sailing by the use of the GPS. Like, I don't know if, you know, can't see any land.
Yep, yep.
Really disorienting. And it's kind of cool that GPS exists.
Yeah, I know. You can imagine what it's like being a pilot with just relying on instruments.
Yeah, interesting. What about for you guys undersea stuff? I mean, I'm assuming GPS doesn't penetrate water, so you can't, like, do anything there, correct? Or
So I mean, the challenge with underwater is LIDAR doesn't work very well underwater because the water just absorbs the LIDAR that we use at this wavelength. I mean, you do get really high powered light and lasers that operate in a different frequency wavelength that can penetrate water, but not for very far. So the general autonomy algorithms that we develop are platform agnostic. So if you had some other sensor, like a side scanning sonar that was giving you range information, we could apply our SLAM and autonomy to other sensors. It doesn't have to be based on LIDAR, but it's definitely a different ball game going underwater with some of these sensors.
Cool. All right. And so a little more in the background. So you were at Australia's National Lab. What, I'm not familiar with that. What goes on there? Is this just a pure R&D lab working on all kinds of cool stuff?
Yeah, it's a mix. So CSIRO is Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, or CSIRO for short. It's government funded, but also sort of at least half of the funding comes from industry as well. So basically they work with industry to solve national problems for Australia and global problems. So in some cases it's consultancy where an industry partner will come to CSIRO and with a problem and we'll put together a dedicated research team to solve that problem and then license the IP to the industry partner for them to commercialize. So commercialization is a big part of the organization, and more recently over the last 4 years there's been a big push for more of a entrepreneurial way of operating within CSIRO. So they've been running an internal accelerator and an entrepreneurial program for the last couple of years, and it's been very well funded, and that's really what sort of gave us the kickstart to go and commercialize the tech that we've been working on for a number of years. Spent while incubating within CSIRO, operating as kind of a spin-in. We were generating revenue. We were we had customers through an early adopter program, and during that time is when we started working on our getting ready for investments and starting the pitching journey. Mm-hmm. And finally, in the last month or so, we closed around and have spun out of the CSIRO, and now we're a separate entity.
What does it look like, or how does it work if the tech was incubated at a research lab like this? Does CSIRO own the IP or just a chunk of the company? How's that work?
Yeah, they're different mechanisms. So the way it worked for us is that they took an equity stake in exchange for IP transfer. Mm-hmm. So our core IP was transferred to Emerson's, and Syro is a shareholder in the company now. In other cases, they license the technology to startups, obviously for an ongoing royalty and maybe a smaller equity stake. But yeah, there are a couple of different models which they commercialize in technology.
And how did you become the one to kind of commercialize it and spin it out? Were there other people interested and you won the bake-off, or were you just the key man on this? Or how's that work?
A couple of things, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, I was project leader on some of the drone autonomy work along with my colleague. So Farid Kandul is my co-founder. So he's spun out with myself. And we, I suppose, had been developing a number of other really amazing drone autonomy capabilities over the last sort of 10 years. And we'd seen that it was really hard to commercialize some of this stuff because it's not something that's easy to just license out to somebody else to go and commercialize. There's a lot of know-how that sort of needs to go with the technology. So when we came across or started working on the HoverMap concept and saw the potential, we decided that, you know, to really make impact and see this commercialized would be best if we did spin out and actually take it out with us, rather than just trying to license it out to somebody else to commercialize. And I got a bit of a sort of the entrepreneurial bug about 5 or 6 years ago. I was involved in another startup, just sort of part-time, another drone startup. So yeah, I really got interested in the whole commercialization side of things. And then, yeah, timing was perfect for us as we were making good progress on the technology side. This accelerator program in CSIRO came along, and we got accepted into the accelerator, and that sort of really accelerated us. I mean, gave us a great opportunity to work on the business side of things. Got us really motivated and excited to spin out with the technology. And that's what we focused on for more than 2.5 years while we were incubating within CSIRO. So yeah, myself and Farid are the co-founders, and then we've got a team of five other technical guys, sort of software engineers and robotics researchers that left CSIRO with us. And now we're hiring a lot more to grow the team.
Cool. Okay, so let's talk about fundraising. So you were in this accelerator, and I guess that probably kind of coached you and prepared you to raise money. Did you raise money as part of like a demo day, or were you, you know, external to CSIRO when raising money? Tell us about that process.
So there wasn't a demo at the end of the accelerator, but we were very fortunate to be involved with a number of mentors and advisors during that process. And two guys in particular really sort of took us under their wings and gave us a lot of their time and really were interested in what we're doing and saw the potential and just sort of were along with us for the journey. And then when the a new fund was formed, and they became partners in that fund. So it was very fortunate for us that they had been along for the ride and seen how we had grown and sort of been learning from the commercialization side. And I mean, we did a lot of work with them and pitching to others, but eventually they were the best fit for us. So that new fund is in Main Sequence Ventures. And it just worked out very well for us that, you know, we'd been, I suppose, involved with some of the partners for a while, and they'd been along with us for the journey, and eventually they are the lead investors that invested in us.
So you mentioned you talked to some other firms. I mean, did you actually get out there and fundraise, or was it more just this relationship with these guys kind of turned into an investment?
It was a bit of both. There was definitely fundraising. So we were in the Bay Area three times. First time was just sort of a go and see and some networking and get to meet people. We were back another two times. Each of those are kind of tentative raising. We were still sorting out the sort of the IP and equity relationship within CSIRO. So until we had sort of really sorted that out, we couldn't go raising in earnest. But we definitely, you know, were speaking to other potential investors and getting feedback from them and understanding really what it takes to, you know, to get the right kind of investment into something like this, whether it's from the US or locally from Australia or from a, you know, pure VC versus a strategic investor. So learned a lot of that side of things, and we did do a lot of pitching, but I think we were probably on the on the lucky side in that we didn't have to pitch to hundreds of VCs. It's probably more in the tens. And all the way along, you know, we had these guys from Main Sequence Ventures that were very keen and helping us, and they introduced us to a lot of the VC firms in the US as potential co-investors. Two of the partners we were working with have connections in the US as well. So it was a mix, but we were very fortunate to have Main Sequence sort of alongside us all the way.
Yeah. Maybe touch a little more on like your Bay Area visits, because this is something that I think founders outside the US always are intrigued by.
Yeah.
How did you set up meetings here? Was it purely through the Main Sequence guys that you knew that were setting it up, or did you, you know, cold outreach, or how did you get some of these sort of road shows going?
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely an eye opener for us. So the first one was a road show organized by the accelerator that we were part of. So that definitely opened doors. The next one was just on our own. We were in the area and had sort of made a couple of relationships, but we did reach out through sort of mutual contacts and reach out to a couple of other VC firms. And then the final one was when we'd already sort of had a good relationship with Main Sequence, and they really reached out with us and on our behalf and made a few more connections. So a bit of everything. But yeah, for us, I think the interesting thing was, you know, going there for the first time and just seeing the difference in scale in terms of, you know, the amount of capital available. And I mean, I can remember being there on the first cohort and giving the pitch, and I can't remember what we were asking for at some point, but it was in the, you know, sub 10, probably, I think we were looking to raise 2 or 3 Australian million at that point. And somebody, you know, one of the potential investors said, well, what would you do with 100 million? You know, and just that kind of mindset. We just, you know, never haven't even dreamed about something like that before. And it really gets you thinking on a different scale. So it was a really good experience and an eye-opener to see that kind of thinking.
Yeah. Did you get pushback being from Australia or conversely just not being local? Did people try and convince you to move here to raise money? Like what was some of the feedback you got on that?
There definitely was some, but not as much as I thought. I mean, I think there are a number of successful Australian startups now who have raised successfully in the Bay Area. And I think that's helping. And also I think these days it's quite accepted to have R&D anywhere in the world, really. I think most VCs that we spoke to understood that in Australia, things are pretty favorable in terms of tax incentives we get, you know, the labor rates here. So it makes sense to do R&D in Australia, especially for the type of stuff we're doing, because the drone regulations here are I think probably better off than trying to do something in the US. And for us, because I mean, we're focusing on underground mining, a lot of our customer base is in Australia, and we have, you know, expertise in mining across the road from us and on the same site. We're also, I think they understood that it makes sense for us to stay here, and none of them were really pushing for us to move to the US. But I have no doubt that if we were based in the US, it would have been a lot easier to raise US based funding as well.
Yeah. Interesting. Great. So let's see, you raised 3.5 million, and then, I think I read somewhere that's about 12, 18 months of runway. Is that right?
Yes. So 18 months on that's 3.5 Australian million, 18 month runway without any revenue. So that's our sort of worst case scenario. We're already generating revenue. So we do expect that to be extended. And then we've got a couple of other sort of non-dilutive funding coming in from government grants and the DARPA project I mentioned. So that'll also extend the runway as well.
And what are you thinking for future rounds? Can you stay in Australia? Do you need to come back to Silicon Valley? How are you kind of thinking about that already?
We're definitely thinking about that. And I think we will try again in the US. Obviously, the big advantage there is the markets that can open. I mean, we already have early adopters and product in the US, but having US based sort of funding, I think, is a whole different level in terms of access to networks and potential customers. So next round in the next 2 years probably will be to scale up and address a number of adjacent verticals, not just underground mining. And also scale out our data analytics platform for analyzing the data that we collect. Mm-hmm. So we'll certainly be back in the US and looking for investment from the US as well. With a main sequence of, they will be able to follow on as well for the next round. So they're definitely in it for the long run.
Are they focused purely on like commercialized R&D or drones? Are they a drone VC firm or?
No, we're their first drone-based investment. So their mandate is really about investing in tech, which is coming out of Australian research organizations. Mm-hmm. And part of their funding is through the CSIRO, and the rest they've raised through LPs. But yeah, they don't have a specific theme that they are focusing on. The fund's been around for a year and a bit now, and they've already got 13 portfolio companies. So they're very active and doing really well. They will be, that fund will be growing as well.
What, this is a bit of a different track here. What are you seeing broadly in the Australian startup scene? What cities are, really the startup hubs? Mm. Any just general trends or observations you can point out about the Australian startup scene?
Yeah, I'm based in Brisbane, so I can speak mainly about what's going on here. And definitely there's a huge surge in startup activity in Brisbane. A new sort of co-working space was opened up a year and a bit ago in the center of Brisbane and downtown Brisbane, and that's been really active and vibrant. So there's a ton of startups in that space.
What's it called?
It's called The Precinct.
Okay.
And it's part of River City Labs. So they had a much smaller sort of venue, and that a year or two ago they expanded to a new building. And yeah, it's a great environment to just go and hang out almost any day of the week. They have presentations and talks going and workshops, and so for us it's great to go and be part of that environment. So that's sort of the Brisbane scene, and I think we're fortunate in that the Queensland government, so that's the state that we're in, it's Queensland, are also very proactive and generous in terms of small businesses and startups. So there's significant funding from the state government for startups like us, and sort of tax breaks, etc. So it's definitely, Queensland is a great place to be in for a startup. And then the big hubs, obviously Melbourne, Sydney, Adelaide, all have very vibrant startup communities as well. But I'm not totally up to speed with what's happening in those areas.
Yeah, good. All right, one or two more questions, and I'll let you get back to mapping out the underground. So, what was it like going from PhD, hardcore scientist, to being founder? What was the most surprising thing about that that trip or that change?
Yeah, great question. I don't think not many people sort of go through that. So it was an interesting experience for me. And I think the biggest learning was when we started the accelerator, on day one, we were told to get out the building and go and speak to customers and find out what their problems were. And it was totally sort of flipping things on its head compared to what we'd been used to doing as a researcher. I mean, as a researcher, you focus on blue sky research and come up with some cool tech and then go and try and find a problem that it solves. Mm-hmm. And flipping that on its head really made me realize that it's not the right way of doing things. So, once we were getting out the building and speaking to customers and actually understanding what problems they had, and then figuring out if what we had, might be a solution, really changed the way I viewed things and made me realize that it's definitely about, finding the problems first and then sort of coming up with the tech or adapting the tech to solve those problems. And then seeing the reaction from those customers when you actually show them something that does help them and does solve their problems is just, it was really, really great experience. So that's been one big learning. But then I think the other way around, there are some other learnings that go the other way. I mean, like just treating the entrepreneurial process as a bit of a science experiment where you come up with hypotheses about, pricing or customers, and then actually test those hypotheses by, going and doing a survey or trying something is something that I think sort of the scientific method can bring to sort of startup land. And I know there are others that are doing that, but definitely that rang true with me and made sense to think of it that way around, as testing some of these things like you would as a scientist.
Yeah, that's become more of a thing. It used to not be such a thing, the whole kind of lean startup and data-driven startups, that's a relatively new thing. You know, it's kind of interesting to see that emerge. So totally makes sense.
I mean, for us, the challenge is some of those, you know, assume that you can run hypotheses very quickly and easily without much cost. But when you're talking sort of deep tech and building hardware and sort of algorithms that take months and years to develop, it's not like just changing a landing page on a website and seeing what response you get. You know, it's a bit harder to test some of those hypotheses when you're doing the kind of stuff that we are doing.
Yeah, I'm sure. Very good. Great. Anything you would do differently if you did this all over again, or any lessons learned that we haven't covered, or have we covered it all?
I think, yeah, I mean, to me, a big lesson is perseverance. So it's, you know, it's been like everybody knows in startup lands, a lot of ups and downs. But I'm glad we rode that out, and we've now up and running commercially. So in terms of doing things differently, not really. I think we've done fairly well, and I would do most of it pretty much the same way. I mean, that's how I've learned. We've made mistakes, and I've definitely learned a lot along the way. And in terms of going forward, I mean, for us now, it's about filling a number of open roles. So we are hiring in a number of areas. So we've got a couple of roles advertised on our website. And it's about, scaling up and getting ready for, expanding to other verticals and really becoming, hopefully, known as the go-to company for underground exploration and mapping using drones.
Yeah. Do you ever worry about Chinese competition? I mean, Chinese aren't they fairly dominant in the drone manufacturing itself? I guess if they were also able to tack on the other components of this, is that something that keeps you up at night or not so much?
Not so much from that area. I mean, they definitely are world leaders in developing sort of drone hardware. I mean, and that's an important reason why we're not focusing on building drones or even, building the HoverMap payload. We do for now, but we're not, that's not our core IP. It's not building hardware. It's more about the algorithms which run on that hardware. And I think that is a bit easier to protect as long as you're careful about what you do. It takes years and years to come up with suitable algorithms to achieve what we've done. The drone space is very, very active. It is a race. There are many others working, on similar problems. So we're definitely not going to sit back and relax. We've got a lot of work to do to keep ahead.
Speaking of a lot of work, I'll let you get back to it.
Okay.
This is fun. Thanks so much. If people want to learn more, it's emascent.io. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah, that's right.
Great.
So we've got some very sparse landing page up and running at the moment, which will be filled out shortly, but there's some videos on there. You can see what we've done in underground space and come and have a look.
It sounds cool. I'll have to go back and watch Prometheus again. I remember it vaguely. I gotta go refresh my memory.
Yeah, you'll definitely recognize the scene I'm talking about. It's a good one.
Yeah. It's fun to see tech mirror, what's in movies sometimes. And it's kind of fun to see it come to life. And it's happening so quickly, right? It's like, kind of hard to keep up. All right. Thank you very much. Well, good luck mapping out the GPS challenge environments of the universe. And we'll catch you after your next round.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Ken.
Thanks. Cheers.
Cheers.